Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, pairing beer and music since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Listen critically, enjoy responsibly.
That's a little bit of the song Once in a Lifetime by Talking Heads off their 1980 masterpiece, Remain in Light. Jim, both of us are huge fans of Talking Heads since their debut record in 1977, when the group burst out of the New York punk scene with a sound pretty much all its own at that time.
A sound and a look, Greg. The core of the band was always singer David Byrne, drummer Chris France, bassist Tina Weymouth, and keyboardist and guitarist Jerry Harrison. Talking Heads was this incredible sonic blend of different elements that would eventually be called new wave, or art pop, or funk, post-punk, you name it. They were all of those things. Among the group's leather-clad contemporaries at CBGB, like the Ramones, the Dead Boys, or the more pop-oriented Blondie, Talking Heads didn't sound like anybody else. And with their khakis and their collared Izod shirts, they didn't look like anybody else either.
Yes, absolutely, Jim, and they went on to have a huge musical career, making 8 albums from 1977 through 1988 and releasing one of the most iconic concert films ever made, Stop Making Sense. Now, each of the 4 members went on to a degree of individual success, and Tina Weymouth and Chris France found a second creative life with their group Tom Tom Club.
This week, we're excited to talk with the drummer of Talking Heads and the person whose idea it was to get the band together in the first place, Chris France. Chris recently released a memoir, Remain in Love, which tells the story of his life in Talking Heads and his personal and professional partnership with Heads and Tom Tom Club bassist Tina Weymouth, France's spouse since 1977. It's an inspiring love story. Chris, welcome to Sound Opinions, and thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure.
Congratulations on this book. It is written in very plain-spoken language, fun to read. It's as if we were sitting on a couch with you, and you're telling us these fascinating tales of you making music. I have got to ask, the accounts of those early tours, and then later ones that we all saw, you know, in on film and everywhere else, are so detailed and vivid, remembering the places, the backstage locales and the faces, and then even giving us the set list. Were you keeping a journal this whole time?
You know, I'm still kicking myself that I didn't keep a journal. In fact, I even went out and bought a couple of journals thinking that I should be keeping a journal, and I never got it together. But fortunately for me, Tina kept date books, not really a journal, but like date books like you buy at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. For example, The one for 1977 has King Tut on the cover. Remember him?
And it was a big deal, yeah.
Tina was our road manager at the time, and so she would write the name of the venue, how many tickets were sold, how many encores we received, and whether or not we liked the promoter. And sometimes she would say, great, great show, 3 encores, got paid, made an additional percentage. Another time she would say, show was not great, never come back here again. but most of them were very positive. Reading Tina's date books helped trigger memories of various events. So she kept very accurate records of where we were and when. That's how I was able to do that.
Tina collected the money too, right? She's the road manager. She was the one that had to go in there and get the money at the end of the gig, right? And, you know, you'd read the stories about, you know, the black musicians on the Chitlin circuit. They had to go in there sometimes armed, you know, because the promoter inevitably would be armed and denying them the money. So in order to get the money, they had to, you know, bring some heat to the negotiation. Did you guys ever have any trouble when you were just starting out getting paid?
There were a couple of times that we didn't get paid properly, but fortunately they were very few, because nobody wanted to get in trouble with Tina. She did. I write about it in the book. More than once, she sat down at the desk with the promoter at the end of the night, and he would have a pistol there as they counted out the cash. In Nashville, the guy counted out the cash, and he overcounted. He gave Tina too much. So she counted it, and she said, "I'm sorry, sir, you've given me too much." And he couldn't believe it. He invited us back very soon because...
an honest band.
Yeah, I think that was pretty rare in his experience.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. You know, the love of making music in this group comes through. I gather it's one reason. Remain in Love is the title. Tina Weymouth, your wife of how many years now?
We recently celebrated our 43rd anniversary. Yeah,
crazy. That is so wonderful. Congratulations. 43 years loving music, loving your wife, obviously. Not always loving what I'm going to call the romantic myth. That there's a genius in a band, right? That it's not a band, that it's not a collaboration between four people, and sometimes five when the producers were significant, right? And the press did that to David Byrne, often ignoring that everybody was writing, everybody was essential to the band. It's you started the band.
Yes, I did. I approached David and said, "How would you like to start a band?" And I brought Tina in. I also brought Jerry Harrison in. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, in Talking Heads, there were four geniuses.
What drew you to David initially? Because he freely owns up to the fact that he was pretty eccentric from the start. He was a difficult character.
He was very awkward socially. But when I played some music with him, I really connected, and he is still is a great rhythm guitarist, which I love, a good rhythm guitar. There was no denying that he had a presence that other people didn't have. He had a certain degree of charisma, but in a way it was kind of like, not exactly charisma, it was almost a reverse charisma that he had in the early days. A train wreck, you might say, because he was so awkward and uncomfortable and sweating and, you know, as he performed, that I think some people thought he was having a nervous breakdown right on stage. Mm-hmm. But that's what I mean by a train wreck. Later, we all became more sophisticated and more polished. But in the early days, we were a challenging band, I mean, aesthetically.
I love the fact in the book that you say that on occasion, since it was the only clean laundry in the loft you and Tina and David shared, David would actually be on stage in some of your Izod polo shirts that Mom had given you for Christmas.
Yeah, David would often wear my shirts just because his own, when you're playing at CBGB's, especially in the summer, you go through shirts really quickly. And I was happy to lend David my shirts. He looked good in them.
Part of the awkwardness that you were talking about was the fact that, you know, here you were this alleged punk band and you didn't look like punks. You were wearing these kind of preppy clothes. And I think a lot of people right away, you stood out as being different. In reading the book, Chris, I got a sense it was just a matter of, hey, these are the clothes we wear. I mean, we're not... looking to make a fashion statement, which in itself was a statement. I mean, did you think it through that much, or was it just a matter of like, hey, here's the nearest shirt I can grab, let's put this on?
We did think it through. Before we ever did a single show, we said, we're not going to dress like the New York Dolls or the Rolling Stones. We're not going to have costumes. We're going to have everyman clothes, like a guy who works at the drugstore would wear, or in Tina's case, a woman who sells shoes would wear. We're going to, you know, be normal looking, and that's going to be our shtick. And it really worked, because all the other bands were dressing up in costumes, and if not the black leather jackets, they were wearing like satin shirts and high-heeled snakeskin boots and things. Mm-hmm. And we were just dressed like some kids from the suburbs, you know. Mm-hmm. And it made a big impression. Some people didn't get it. I remember Johnny Thunders coming up to me after our first performance and saying, "Are you guys a feminist band?"
Yeah, yeah, and, I love that.
I said to him, "Yes, as a matter of fact, we are."
Mommy, Daddy, come and look at me now. I'm a big man in a great big town. Here's a girl who would be, believe it's true. Goes to show what a little faith can do. I was complaining, I was down in the dumps. I felt so strong, I thought you pulled me up, pulled me up, 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 up.
Also key, I think, and you really highlight this, was the love from the beginning of black music. Black grooves, yeah. Motown grooves, funk grooves. And of course, a lot of that comes from you. A lot of it comes from Tina, but she approaches it from the world of classical music and plays it in her own completely unique way. But I wonder, you talk about your Army brat upbringing. Born in Kentucky, travel around a lot. Dad was a general eventually. I wonder how you came to be such a lover of black music.
First of all, the way it sounds. I love the way it sounds, but I went for a couple of years to school in Virginia, Episcopalian boarding school for boys. And I was a music lover, and I had like my Beatles records, my Stones records, my Byrds records. And one of the guys in my dormitory said, "Oh man, you can't listen to that." He said, "You got to listen to soul. I'm going to get you James Brown live at the Apollo." And he went and got it, and he put it on my little record player in my room. You know, the first James Brown live at the Apollo album. And I thought, oh, man, I see what you're talking about. This is really something. And then he also introduced me to Stax, which I was familiar with Motown because that was all over the airwaves, but where I lived. But Stax, not so much. And so Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, Booker T and the MGs, all that was a real turn on for me. But at the same time, Bob Dylan came out and the Velvet Underground came out right at that same time. And I was an appreciator of all kinds of music. But as a drummer, I found soul music, you might say, the most compelling because it was funky and you could dance to it. You could really dance to it.
Yeah, that element was not overly present in the scene that you came up in. You know, the groove.
Right.
You guys had that. The other bands really didn't. I mean, the Ramones were a great band, but they were certainly not a groove, funky band. You had that influence of the funk, but it was seemed very contemporary the way you guys weaved it in there. And was that just kind of, I mean, obviously the influence was there for you, but did everybody share in that right from the get-go? How did that sort of evolve sound-wise? Were you writing songs with that sort of danceable groove right away?
We were attempting to write songs with a danceable groove right away. And we didn't always succeed, but that was our goal. Mm-hmm. And our other goal was to write songs that were maybe not exactly predictable for a rock group. For example, Don't Worry About the Government, that song. Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine any other band at that time playing that song.
Pretty radical, and the songwriting, I think you did a nice job in the book, Chris, of sort of talking about the collaborative aspects of that. And you know, I scanned the credits on those early records, and it doesn't appear that you guys really got the credit you deserved. Did that cause any tension? I imagine it did, but was it, some bands break up over that kind of stuff. You guys held it together. How did you manage?
We could have quit the band over that, but then there wouldn't have been any Talking Heads. So we knew that even from the very early days, we knew that Talking Heads had some unique chemistry going on that other bands didn't have, and we it was important to us. We shared a lot of aesthetic ideas. We had similar tastes in what we were hoping to accomplish. And Tina and I learned, and Jerry also learned very early on that, you know, David is just wired in a different way than other people, than you and me. It's difficult for him to understand where he ends and other people begin. So if he's collaborating with you on a song, everything goes great. You know, there's give and take. You have an idea. He says, oh, that's good. And he has an idea and you say, oh, yeah, man, that's great. And it all comes together. And then David says, oh, look at this wonderful song I've written. And he kind of forgets that other people were there, too. And so we learned early on that this is what we're dealing with. And if we want to keep the band going and the music flowing and the whole gestalt of the thing, we're going to have to learn to live with this. And we did. It's not like we didn't call him out on it from time to time. Like, David, you seem to have forgotten that I wrote those lyrics. He would say, oh, we'll change it on the second pressing.
Wow.
It's sad to read those parts of the book. And you don't do it in a, I'm going to, you know, stab him in the back way. I mean, it just seems, at one point you suggest that David was somewhere on the spectrum, you know, as you just said now, you know, difficult to deal with, saw things his own way. But it just, it had to have taken a toll on you and Tina and Jerry.
Well, it was a challenge, but one thing I'm trying to convey in this book is, you know, when people have written about Talking Heads in the past, they often accentuate the conflicts that we had. Every band has conflicts, but it gets kind of boring to hear about those conflicts over and over again. With this book, I was trying to convey that despite some conflicts, we had wonderful times, very exciting times, and not just once or twice, but for years. And we worked really hard, and we did great work together. And so I want people to know that Talking Heads was a shared experience and that it was an excellent experience. I've said it before, if I had to do it all over again, I would, because that's how good it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, the great irony when you hear about how the Ramones were at each other's throats for so long, or some of the conflicts that were part of Talking Heads, or, you know, is that I remember being a kid when Talking Heads 77 came out, WPIX, New York's new wave radio station, and then comes Tina. Bump, bump, bump. I was coming from my first concert at Madison Square Garden, Jethro Tull. Right? Nothing Jethro Tull did that night made me think I could do that. And then I hear Psycho Killer. And it's like, hey, I can, maybe I could do that in my basement with those drums my stepdad gave me. I can't seem to face up to the facts. Wow. You know, the great message was, Patti said it, Patti Smith, this is the era where everybody creates. Do it. Do something yourself. You know, and that's the joy, I think, that comes across in Remain in Love. You know, you got something to say. What's stopping you? Whether it's going to be the visual art you and Tina were always doing, or making the music, or you know, films later, or the audacity for the drummer and the bassist to start a band called Tom Tom Club.
Yeah, that turned out pretty well.
I'd say more hits than David ever had as a solo act.
Yeah. Yes. It's not a contest, you know. Some people try to make it into a contest, but I was just happy that we had the success we had. I wish David had had the same amount of success with his... he's doing well now on Broadway, very well, playing Talking Head songs.
Mm-hmm. You know. Even then, there's an anecdote in the book that Seymour Stein, the guy who signed you to Sire Records, Talking Heads... Uh-huh. Was skeptical about you and Tina doing a solo record. He said, I already signed David and Jerry to solo deals. I don't need another band, was the anecdote.
Yeah.
And yet you had the first big major hit of anybody in the band.
Yes.
There must have been a little feeling of satisfaction when that happened.
It was extremely gratifying and also a pleasant surprise as much for Tina and I as it was for everybody else. But that song was mega, Genius of Love. Mm-hmm. And before it, Wordy Rapping Hood. I mean, you know, talk about crossover. We crossed over, baby.
It was inspiring to hear that in discos and in black clubs and in CBGB or the Ritz at that period in New York.
Yeah, or Danceteria or the Mud Club. Yeah.
When we come back, more of our conversation with Talking Heads drummer Chris France. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.